This season, we're launching a new episode of The Missing every week. But if you don't want to wait, all episodes are currently available completely ad-free on What's the Story Crime. Signing up is really easy. Just follow the link in our show notes. You're guaranteed to find your new favourite true crime listen. From con men to missing people, forensic investigations to miscarriages of justice, What's the Story Crime is the home for all true crime fans who want bingeable, addictive, crime-based content.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
The Missing is produced by What's the Story Sounds. They also make lots of other great content, which I think you might like. Why not sign up for What's the Story Crime? On there, you'll find series including The Missing completely ad-free, as well as bonus content and even entire series you can't hear elsewhere. Signing up is super easy. Just search for What's the Story Crime in Apple Podcasts or follow the link in our show notes to get access on whatever platform you prefer to listen on. All the information is also available on www.whatsthestorysounds.com/crime. When a person goes missing, there are numerous scenarios as to their disappearance, so police can never initially be sure what they are dealing with. Are they looking for a runaway who doesn't want to be found? Has the missing person been the victim of a planned or even opportunistic crime? Maybe they've simply forgotten to communicate where they're going and will turn up at home in a few days' time. Whatever the scenario, the first 24 hours of any search are vital. But with 20 missing people reports coming into every British police force every single day, priorities have to be made. And whether subconsciously or consciously, research has shown that missing people from ethnic minority groups are routinely marked lower priority. The outrageous truth is that if you're not white, you're more likely to be missing for longer or never found at all. Stephen Durand was 31 when he went missing in Salford in the northwest of England. He was a mixed-race man who walked with a limp due to cerebral palsy. He had learning difficulties and mental health problems and was known to the local police as vulnerable. The last sighting of Stephen was on October the 20th, 2018. He was captured on CCTV, wearing a black coat and grey sweatpants, holding a can of fizzy drink. Salford was not an area Stephen usually visited. His family have no idea why he was there, and they are yet to find out, because that CCTV footage of Stephen, it's the last anyone ever saw of him. I'm Pandora Sykes, and you're listening to The Missing, a What's the Story original podcast series brought to you with the help of the charities Missing People and Locate International. They believe that all of the cases in this series could still be solved. This is The Missing, Stephen Durand. In 1987, Stephen Durand had a dramatic entrance into the world.
10 weeks before my due date, they rushed me to hospital and had emergency caesarean with Stephen. He was weighed at 3.5 pounds and he was very sick and ill. He had a hernia and his breathing was bad and I thought I was going to lose him.
Christine, Stephen's mum, remembers him being whisked away by doctors who transferred him to another hospital for an emergency operation.
So I had to go home with no baby and then... I don't like talking about it.
It was a few days before Christine was able to meet her son.
It was heartbreaking. So too many tubes. I wasn't allowed to feed him because he had tubes being fed and everything. So, and I weren't allowed to hold him at first. Compared to my other babies, he was very, very tiny. He kept smiling, and I think it was wind, but I thought he was smiling at me. Yeah, I was a bit scared to hold him because he was so tiny, but I managed. It was so good to hold him after such a long time because it was hard not being able to hold him, you know. When you have your baby, you want to hold him quick, don't you? But yeah, that was heartbreaking, but he was special. He was special because he was so tiny, so... They were like my special little baby. They had to take him out of the incubator, but he still had all his tubes attached, so I could just hold him with all the tubes in and then put him back. But the bleep kept going off, so I didn't hold him for long because I was a bit scared in case something went wrong.
Stephen spent the first few weeks of his life in an incubator, in a specialist unit, where Christine would visit him every day, until after more than 6 weeks, he was finally allowed home.
I went to pick him up with my husband, and when he put a lot of weight on and he was ready to come home, he had tubes all over him and everything, but he gained his weight, and we got him home, and thank God, and he managed to start putting his weight back on, and then he had a few more hospital appointments to attend, but in the end he did okay, and he ended up outweighing all the premature babies, and he was 5'10" and big and stocky at the end, so he turned out really well.
The family lived in London, and baby Stephen came home to Christine, his dad, and 2-year-old twin sisters. When Stephen was 6 months old, his parents split up. Christine and the children moved back to her hometown of Preston in the northwest of England.
I came back to Preston to live with my sister, who was married, and she had children of her own. I went with my children to move there, and I was happy to get away at the time. And we ended up staying at my sister's for about 6 or 7 months, and I got rehoused then. I brought them up on my own.
Christine and her children were settling into their new life when she noticed that Stephen was struggling with his walking.
When he was about 13 months, when he was walking on his tiptoes, took him back to the hospital, and they found out he had mild cerebral palsy. He had a lot of physio that came round to the house, and he had to do physio exercises. But I had to do his stretching on his legs every day.
Stephen's cerebral palsy meant he needed an operation to loosen the tendons in his legs, and there were constant medical appointments. But he dealt with the curveballs admirably.
he had problems. He had to wear calipers on his legs and he had special boots. You know, we had to go to the places where they made his boots and fitted him. But it never bothered him. It never really bothered him. He just got on with it. He was no problem. He wasn't, and this is absolutely the truth. I never had any problem. He hardly ever cried. He was laughing all the time. And he always had a big smile on his face.
By the time Stephen was 5, the family had moved a few miles down the road to another town called Chorley, where he started at the same school as his older sisters.
He did go to school and he enjoyed school and he had lots of little friends that came round and he used to go playing out with them, but he was a bit of a clown. He used to like making people laugh all the time and a bit disruptive at times, but yeah, he got a good report.
Throughout primary school, besides a few minor incidents, his time there was mostly happy. But as Stephen grew, he began to feel self-conscious about his cerebral palsy.
He didn't like wearing his splints when he got a bit older because I think he was a bit embarrassed about some at school and that. But yeah, he had special boots. Some of his boots he liked because they got them fashion ones, you see. But yeah, but as soon as he got 9 or 10 and he wouldn't wear his splints and he wouldn't wear his boots. He wanted to be like all the other kids and, you know, wear normal things.
By the time he got to secondary school, he was keen to find ways to fit in.
He was the class clown and he wanted to make everybody laugh because everybody was laughing at him.
But this didn't make him popular with the teachers.
He wasn't concentrating properly. They said he's got the ability to learn, but he messed around a bit. He did get excluded a couple of times because he was a bit disruptive in class.
Stephen was diagnosed with learning difficulties and he received additional support, but his behaviour gradually got worse.
He started being a bit naughty, were like not doing his own work in the end, and he wanted to be out all the time, and I think he started then going around with the wrong crowd a bit. He ended up smoking a bit of weed and that, because I found some in his bedroom and he said it was his.
At 16, Stephen left school. He didn't have any qualifications, but he quickly found himself a job in a local shop.
He got a job at Spa, but it didn't last long because he kept being late after that, because they were going out at night and I think they finished him because he wasn't turning up. He did keep saying to me, "Mum, I'll try, I'll get another job and all this." But his mental health wasn't that good. It wasn't, well, I could tell there was something wrong with him.
Stephen liked to go out drinking with his friends.
Sometimes the police would fetch him back with being drunk. And they fetched him back one night being drunk in charge of a push bike. And he can't remember where he got the push bike. And they fetched him back and told him to get to bed and everything. But he started drinking a bit more. And I kept saying, you know, what's wrong with you and all this? And then sometimes he would argue with me and say it's none of my business and all that. But I knew that he weren't so far away anyway, but I always told him to be careful and be careful what you're doing and always come back. And
Christine thinks Stephen was using alcohol to cope with the negative comments about his limp.
I think his disability, because he used to say to me sometimes that people calling him because he walked funny and all this, and I think that affected him a lot, you know, in his mind, and he used to fight back, but I think deep down it affected him a lot, you know, and people calling him names because he walked funny, and I think the drink helped him to block it out a bit.
It wasn't just Stephen's drinking that was causing his mum to worry.
Sometimes he was like really high and happy one day when he wake up. Like, he's dancing around saying, oh, I'm really happy. And then a few hours later, he could be so quiet and he wouldn't get a word out of him. And I thought, his mood's changing. He would do things on impulse. He'd be sat down in the house and he'd be there in his pyjamas. And then all of a sudden he said, I'm going out now. I said, where are you going? He said, I don't know, I'll just go. And even when he was about 13, he'd jump on a bus and go somewhere. And he'd ring me up and say, I'm in Lytham or I'm in Thingy, Outfit Day. And he'd just go, he said, I said, what are you doing? He said, I'm just walking around. And he would do that a lot, get a train somewhere and just go. And he says, I'll be back. And he always come back. He used to do a lot of things without thinking about it. He'd just do it. And I used to say that you get yourself in danger, keep doing that, going to places you don't know.
When Stephen was about 19 years old, he was taken under the care of the local mental health service.
They first diagnosed him with bipolar. And then another meeting, they said, no, we change it to a personality disorder. Then they changed it to schizoaffective disorder. And then they changed it to paranoid schizophrenia. I don't think the psychiatrist knew exactly what were the problems. They knew there was something wrong, but they didn't know exactly.
With support from carers, Stephen was able to start living independently in a flat of his own.
It didn't last long because he had housefuls in, parties and everything like that. And they was taking all his food. Not all of them, but some of them were taking his food.
Stephen was receiving disability benefits and people were turning up at his flat for parties on the days he withdrew it.
I went to his flat a few times. I said, you've got to stop this partying and all this. I said, the neighbours and everything, you've got to think. And the neighbours are complaining. And he used to be sat there. He says, I've no food and no electric. All my money's gone and everything. But he'd do the same thing a week later, and he'd do it again. And I said, what's going on, you know? Why are you doing all this? And he said, it don't matter. I'm not bothered. Well, I said, Stephen, they can't let people just take, you know, use you like that and just use your house and your electric and your food.
Christine believes people were taking advantage of her son, and she'd tell him as much, but Stephen would always disagree.
He said, Mum, they're my friends. But he wouldn't get in his head that half of them wasn't his friends. They were just people to take advantage of him. But the social worker said that's to do his mental health. You know, he thinks they were his friends. He did have some friends that cared about him and helped him, but a lot of them knew that he was so vulnerable. He'd let them in and he would buy them all drinks, feed them all, get them takeaways. But they'd leave him in their house full of mess. And this just went on and went on.
Stephen moved house a number of times, but the parties and the hangers-on always followed.
He did live in Manchester for a little while, in Withenshaw. But the same thing happened there. I used to have to travel to Manchester. There was some lads there that smashed all his flat up, and he didn't bother. He would never ring the police. He would never get the police involved or anything. They did it to his flat in Manchester. I got him back to move back here. And he just let anybody walk all over him and everything. And I said, you're not a doormat.
Every once in a while, Stephen managed to stop drinking and get himself into a good routine.
He was a very, very clean person. Don't get me wrong, he was very clean. He had shower in the morning, shower before he went to bed. When he was right in the head, he cleaned his flat from top to bottom. And he said, Mum, I'm not having anybody in. And he did it for 6 months without letting anybody, no drink, no drugs, no nothing. And I was so proud of him.
At this point in time, Christine and Stephen were inseparable.
We used to go out for days. I used to go to his flat. We used to go to bingo, or we used to, because he loved bingo. And he loved, in the summer, we used to go to Blackpool, Lytham, St. Thomas. We went all over to the days out. And he loved that. He knew when I was upset. I knew when he was upset. We just got on. Like, he was like a brother to me. He was a son, a brother, everything, my best friend. And we did a lot of belly laughing together, and he's the only one that could make me belly laughing. I knew everything about him.
In the market for investment-worthy bags, watches, and fine jewelry, Rebag is the answer. Rebag is a luxury resale platform where each piece is carefully inspected by experts to ensure quality and authenticity. Use Rebag to buy and sell finds from the world's top brands, including Louis Vuitton, Chanel, and Cartier. Head to Rebag.com and get up to 15% off your first purchase as a member with code REBAGNEW. Shop today at Rebag.com. That's REBAG.com. And use promo code REBAGNEW for up to 15% off your first purchase as a member.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-.
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Despite his own troubles, Stephen was always looking for ways to help others.
One day when I went to his flat, he had a homeless man there. I said, who's that man? He went, Mum, he's nowhere to live. He said, I'll let him in and I'll let him have a bath and I'll give him some food. I said, you don't know him? And he went, no. I said, Stephen, he could be anybody, you know. But that's what he was. He was struggling himself, but he helped people that were struggling as well. He was that way out. That's the way Stephen was. And he loved his family. He loved his nieces and nephews and his sisters. He was kind to everybody.
But whenever Stephen fell off the wagon, he would ask his mum for space.
And he'd always ring me and say, Mum, I'm out with all my mates. Please do not keep ringing me. Please leave me alone, I'll be fine. And I didn't ring him or anything. And then I says, ring me when you get home then. And then he used to go home and he would sleep it all off for a couple of days and then he'd get back to normal again.
Stephen carried on in this way throughout his 20s, oscillating between being on the straight and narrow, when he would enjoy spending time with his mum, and indulging in prolonged episodes of drinking that would cause him to isolate and inevitably lead to a steep decline in his mental health.
And he would ring me up and say, the television's talking to me. Hears the voices and things like that, and he was very paranoid in the end, and he thought people were outside his flat calling his names, and he thought people were out to get him. And I said, Stephen, just ring the crisis team or get them involved or anything. And then he'd say, no, I'm going out. And then he would back to square one.
For a period of time before he went missing, Stephen found himself in a purple patch, where he was maintaining good habits. He was living back in Preston near his mum. They were speaking every day and spending all their weekends together. Stephen also had a psychiatrist he trusted and carers who visited his home twice a day.
And he loved the carers going in because it was company for him, and they made sure that he did his shopping. Well, he always did his shopping anyway, but...
The carers made sure Stephen took his medication, which was locked away for his safety, because he'd been in hospital for overdosing previously. But things went downhill again when Stephen's psychiatrist left his job.
Stephen did miss a couple of appointments with the new psychiatrist that he had, and he told me, Stephen, they don't know me like that other one, and they're not really bothered about my illnesses and that. They said they don't know me. That they said they're not reading my files, and they're out to discharge me. And I said, no, Stephen, they won't discharge you because you've been there a long, long time and all this.
After Stephen missed several appointments, he was told he'd been discharged, and he called his mum in a panic.
I said, why? And he went, they're discharging me for not going for a couple of times. He said, I'm going to get no help. I said, oh, no, they can't do that. And he went, oh, yeah, they can. He said, they've done it. And he got upset. And I was upset. And I said, well, you need to get back in touch with him and tell him. He said, Mum, they've discharged me. All my carers are going. I've got nobody coming. And he went, I'm not going back to that flat. I don't want to go back to that flat.
Stephen ended the phone call saying he was going to Chorley, where he had friends and acquaintances to drink with. He didn't return to his flat for a few days, and Christine was concerned that, without being under the watchful eye of his usual carers, Stephen wasn't taking his medication. Stephen stayed at his own flat for a short time before Christine received a phone call from her daughter, one of Stephen's sisters.
My daughter rang me up and said, oh, Stephen's here, because what he'd do if he went to Chorley, he has his sisters there, and if ever he didn't have the bus fare or, you know, he didn't want to go all the way home, they would put him up and he'd stay there. So that night, he had gone to my daughter's house. And so I spoke to Stephen. I said, what are you doing in Chorley again? I told you to keep away from Chorley. It's bad for you, you know, because I know what he was up to when he went to Chorley. And he went, no, Mum, I'm going home. I'm going home in a bit. And he borrowed £5 off bus fare off my daughter to get home.
Christine felt reassured upon hearing that Stephen was headed home.
I thought he'd be home and he'd sleep it off because, you know, he'd stay up for a couple of days. And I thought he'd be at home and I thought, well, and he said he was going home.
Being mindful to give Stephen space, Christine didn't call him immediately.
I gave it 5 days because sometimes I thought he could have gone back to his mates and all because he told me never to ring and everything. Well, after 5 days or 6 days, I thought he's not rung me. He must have had enough sleep by now.
And so Christine called her son, but Stephen's phone was turned off.
I kept ringing, no noise or anything. It was just off, but my daughter said he didn't have a phone when he went to her house, so he must have lost it the night before or something, or it's gone missing. I rang the police and then I said, you know, I want you to check on my son because he meant to go home.
Police visited the flat to see if Stephen was there.
And then that's when I found out, well, the police found out that he hadn't been home.
Stephen was nowhere to be found. He was registered as a missing person, and the police launched an investigation to track him down.
And that's when I found out the next thing, the police with the video saying he's in Salford. He didn't know anybody, as far as I know, in Salford. So I thought, what's he done there for?
Salford is a small city about 20 miles from Chorley. CCTV shows Stephen in a shop called Bargain Booze at 7 a.m. on the 20th of October 2018, the day after he left his sister's house.
He didn't have no money, only that fiver what my daughter gave him. He didn't have no clothes. He didn't have no money. He didn't have nothing.
In the grainy CCTV footage recovered from Bargain Booze, Stephen is seen leaving the shop with a soft drink.
He was seen in the video with a can of Vimto. He liked Vimto. He weren't drinking. He weren't drunk or anything. So what made him go there, I do not know. I think he looked very nervous in that video, in that shop. A bit scared of things, putting his lips together. But the police reckoned that he looked okay on that video. But I said, no, he doesn't. He looks nervous.
It's not known how or why Stephen ended up in Salford, but police did manage to trace some of his prior movements. They discovered that after leaving his sister's house, Stephen had attempted to use a cash machine in Chorley. He then made his way to Manchester. The police believe that Stephen boarded a train, but CCTV wasn't found to confirm this. So Christine wonders if someone would have given him a lift. We know from the shop CCTV that by the next morning, Stephen had travelled to Salford, which is just a few miles from Manchester. He was at the Bargain Booze shop on Swinton Road at 7 a.m. And then one other sighting was confirmed at a Premier store on Agecroft Road at about 11 a.m. These shops are just 1 mile apart, so Stephen could easily have walked between them. And that is where the police trail to find Stephen Durand runs cold. To gather new leads on Stephen's movements, the police engaged the local media, but they made a vital error with Stephen's physical description.
When they first put it out in the papers, I was shocked to see missing person Stephen Durand described as white. I thought, he's not white. I said, why have you put it as white? I said, he's mixed race. It took them ages to take it off. And then when it come to another newspaper, I think it was Chorley Guardian or something, it was white again. So I had to ring them up again to tell them, you know he's mixed race, they're looking for a white person.
Stephen is a mixed race man. He is 5'10", of stocky build, and at the time of his disappearance, he had short, dark, cropped hair. He was wearing a black jacket with grey jogging bottoms and red trainers. But the initial media coverage, mistakenly describing him as white, did not generate any new leads.
They could have spotted him, and they said, well, it's not him because he's mixed race, and we're not looking for a mixed race, looking for a white person. So that was vital, that. They should have really made sure, and with his noticeable limp, and he was big built, he was 5'10", stocky. Somebody must have seen him. Somebody must have noticed that limp.
In the first year after Stephen's disappearance, there were several moments when the authorities thought they might have found something.
I got one phone call saying we have found a leg in the River Irwell. Would I be able to identify it? To see if it was Stephen's. I said, yeah, if I have to. And then I got a phone call a few days later saying, oh, it's okay, it was a lady's leg. I said, oh. Then there was another time when the police rang me up and said, there's a black jacket been found not long after Stephen went missing. I said, oh. I said, he was wearing a black jacket. I said, can I see it? And then they said, well, we'll see. And then they said, oh, we found out it wasn't Stephen's.
Over the last few years, there have been no new sightings of Stephen or any fresh leads linked to his case.
Nobody's come forward, and they told me the police, because they haven't got a lead to go on, there's nothing they can do but just hope. One day somebody might speak up or something. So I'll never know to this day what happened. And I'm thinking, somebody's hiding something. They must be hiding something.
Christine believes that whatever happened to Stephen happened on the day he was last seen, Saturday the 20th of October 2018. Stephen was waiting for his disability benefits to be paid into his account, which is why he was seen at the cash machine in Chorley the day before.
This is very important because I told the police this. That's why I said to the police, please check his bank account because I know he had no money and that's his payday. That was his payday and he would definitely have gone in the bank. So I said, can you check his bank account?
When police checked Stephen's bank account, his benefits were still there, completely untouched.
He would have definitely gone to the cash machine to get some money out because he was absolutely, he had nothing. He had nothing with him. And he would have bought some cigarettes. Well, something must have happened in Salford. And I've told the police many a time, something's definitely happened because he never got to that cash machine.
We know Stephen was last seen at the shop on Agecroft Road, Salford, at 11 a.m. on Saturday, the 20th of October.
Something happened in Salford. That is the key place, because they never got no more CCTVs apart from that shop. Where did he go when he left that shop? Which way did he turn?
So where did he go from there? And why did he not collect the money from his bank? These are questions Christine has been asking herself for over 5 years.
How can they vanish off thin air? How the hell can people not notice? And with him being noticeable limp, somebody must have spotted him. Somebody must know. At the beginning, I thought, is the drug dealer's been, you know, got him? But he never owed any money to anybody. They owed him more. That's because he lent money out. But you hear these things, don't you? And I thought, well, if anybody that violent that took him, they would have took his money and made him go to the cash machine and take his money, you know, because that's what people do. They want your money, don't they? But because his bank never been touched, that went out of me. And I thought, well, they don't want his money.
Could it be possible that Stephen came to harm at the hands of someone else? But then why didn't they take any of his money? Or could Stephen have sadly taken his own life? We know Stephen has a history of overdosing, but when he went missing, he didn't have his medication with him. And if he did hurt himself somehow, why has his body not been found? Perhaps Stephen decided to disappear and is living rough on the streets. But surely he'd have collected the money in his bank account first. And with his mental health problems, wouldn't he eventually have been picked up by the authorities? As a vulnerable man, could Stephen have been picked up and trafficked, a victim of modern-day slavery?
He would talk to anybody. He's happy-go-lucky. He's happy. If someone said, come on, come with us, we'll take you somewhere. He trusted everybody. He was vulnerable. He thought everybody was his friend, but, you know, he didn't think about danger much. He put himself in danger. God knows what's happened. He could have easily got in a car with someone. All things go through your mind. I had a lot of sleepless nights. No, it's a mystery. It's a complete mystery.
Living without answers has a huge impact on Christine and her family.
We all miss him so much. My daughters don't like, they keep everything bottled. I get upset, and I couldn't speak about Stephen for ages. I couldn't, because it upsets me. We were just so close, and he's so special to me. He was special from the day we were born because he was so tiny, and because he was disabled, that even made me so close to him. He got spoilt more than the others because he was special. And he still is special. He'll always be special.
Christine and his sisters live in hope that Stephen could still be found.
Someone might come forward one day. Sometimes people get found after 10 years, don't they, sometimes? I still hear his voice in my head. I can still hear him call, Mum, Mum. I kiss his picture in the morning. I say, good morning, good night at night. And, you know, it's hard.
In many cases, it takes just one piece of information to lead police and family to the answers they crave. Perhaps you were in Swinton on the morning of October the 20th and saw Stephen going in or out of the Bargain Boos on Bolton Road. Or maybe you were in Pendlebury a few hours later and spotted him on the Agecroft Road. Your information, however half-remembered, could be vital. Visit our website, themissingpodcast.org, where you'll find more information on this and every other case we featured in the series. On our site, you can join the conversation and help with the investigation. There's a dedicated forum, moderated carefully by Locate, where you can get updates on the case share your theories, and discuss the facts with real investigators from Locate International. The series is also made with the help of Missing People, a charity who offers support to the families of the missing. Their helpline is open to offer support and advice if you've been affected by anything in this episode. We can't say this enough. It takes just one person with the right information to solve any of the cases in this series. Christine and her family hope that the information will soon arrive to solve this one. The Missing is a What's the Story original podcast series. It's presented by me, Pandora Sykes. This episode was produced and written by Carla Wright. It's edited by Jack O'Kennedy. The executive producers for What's the Story Sounds are Daryl Brown and Sophie Ellis.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
This season, we're launching a new episode of The Missing every week. But if you don't want to wait, you can listen to them exclusively on What's the Story Crime. Just search for What's the Story Crime in Apple Podcasts or follow the link in our show notes to get access on whatever platform you prefer to listen on. All the information is also available on www.whatsthestorysounds.com/crime.